and welcome to a special edition of EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. EWTN's James Day visited the Napa Institute 2024 Summer Conference, where he sat down with several popular authors to discuss their books. Here's a conversation James had with author Noelle Meering.
I'm pleased to be joined by Noelle Meering. She's the author of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. That's 2021 TAN Books. Yep. Noelle, thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
First question. You talk in the book of a crisis of meaning. Tell me what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think part of what happens with the woke movement, as with any sort of revolutionary ideology, is that it collapses all sources of meaning into the material world. And so there's no place for a telos, a purpose, an end to our bodies, to our lives, to the things we encounter in the world, in the natural world. And there's no origin either. So what happens is that there is only the meaning that we choose to give to something. And you can see this really clearly in the sexual revolution, that our bodies can be used for as whatever we want, as so long as as there's consent. The only, sort of moral framework is whether or not it's consensual. And I think what happens then is that, we inevitably run up against the sort of spiritual dynamics that are going to make our lives frustrated, not flourishing, because we're not working in accord with our nature. And I think we see a lot of people kind of experiencing the fallout from all of this sort of moral chaos, that they don't find that there's meaning to their lives, nor meaning to their bodies, meaning to their homes. And I do think that is a real crisis, because I think we know on some level that we are not God. I can't just inject whatever meaning I choose to into my life, that there is a way in which I need to live in accord with my nature in order for it to flourish. And so I think it leads to a lot of despair. There was a great quote that I heard recently, and I forget who said it, that it's not suffering that's unbearable, it's meaningless suffering. So if we don't understand that there's meaning in our everyday lives, meaning in the hardships, meaning to our bodies, then, things become pretty unbearable pretty quickly. And I think we're seeing that a lot today.
Now, I can ask what led you to write this book, but the title alone, we know where you're coming from, Awake, Not Woke. You're really seizing the kind of the zeitgeist with what's going on with this ideology. But to actually go ahead and research, to write it, to put it out there, to edit, the whole gamut of writing a book takes a lot of effort. So what propelled you then to say, I'm going to do this?
Yeah. I started writing articles about the woke movement around 2018. And it became clear to me that it really is able to capture people through manipulation. Manipulation of, what ought to be right, compassionate responses. Our instincts towards compassion and walking with the suffering are greatly manipulated by the movement. Also manipulation by fear. I think a lot of people are silenced because they are afraid of speaking up when it's not popular to, afraid of losing maybe our platform or livelihoods through cancellation. And then the third stage is manipulation by force. And so I think once it became clear to me that how manipulative this was, it also became clear that we really have to shine light on it. We have to understand how this movement works, what are the tenets of it, in order to defeat it. And that insofar as we kept things in the dark and didn't talk about it and didn't study it and didn't expose it, then it was going to run rampant all over society.
And correct me if I'm wrong, some of those articles were through the National Catholic Register,
Yes.
Service of EWTN. Why do you think Christians are too cowardly?
Well, I think that, there are oftentimes, there's two extremes and then the virtue in the middle, right? There's cowardice and then there's rashness, and right in the middle is courage. And I think that at different times we might tend to err on one extreme or the other. There might be times when Christians have been too rash or too, bombastic or something about the faith. Now I think we're kind of in the era of being too cowardly. And I think that that's, in a lot of ways, because we don't want to appear unloving. Love is at the center of the faith, and so if a Christian is accused of being unloving, then they're really accused at the very heart of what Christianity is supposed to be. And so I think that confuses a lot of people. And they think, well, I don't want to appear that way, and maybe it's going to sully my mission field. People are going to be turned away, and so I'm just going to be silent about controversial things. The danger there, of course, is that it's the controversial things that are really harming people, that we really have to understand the nature of the human person, where our dignity lies, how we ought to live. And if we kind of just say, well, we're going to cede the territory of human anthropology to, you know, the progressive ideology, well, we're ceding a lot. We're ceding people's lives, people's ability to flourish, and their ability to understand the nature of God himself. So I think there's, I understand why it's hard to speak out and hard to, you know, defend the church's teaching on human anthropology, but it is utterly essential.
You know, you you cover a lot of ground, a lot of historical ground in the book in a very succinct way. Specifically, tell me a little bit about the Frankfurt School and how that factors into the research you did for the book.
Sure. So the Frankfurt School was a group of German Marxists and Freudians, acolytes of Freud, and they formulated an institute of social research in Frankfurt, Germany, after realizing that, you know, the revolution that Marx had promised would occur was inevitably, would inevitably occur, had not occurred. And so they formed this research institute to try to decipher, okay, what went wrong, how do we seed revolution, particularly in the West. They matriculated to the United States in 1935, sort of welcomed by, became adjacent to Columbia University, and then became known as the Frankfurt School. And here is where they really discerned and realized, okay, if we're going to seed revolution, it cannot just be on economic terms or class warfare. We have to find other ways of dividing people, man versus woman, race stoking race wars. You know, people are living more on the fringe of society versus more mainstream people. How do we stoke the antagonisms, resentments, and grievances of various groups and then see the ideology through all of this division, sort of creating the movement by defining people in opposition to each other. So they really understood that, you know, we have to capture the institutions of learning, for one thing. So a lot of the revolutionaries went on, really saw it, and rightfully so, that education is incredibly powerful. And if you can seed a revolutionary mindset in the academic world, certainly the universities, but also the teachers' colleges, you can really disseminate a lot of ideology throughout the nation pretty rapidly, because you capture sort of the representatives of various school or dioceses or universities, then they go back to their institutions, and then it spreads from there. So, but also media, they were very aware of the influence of popular culture, particularly in America, that we're a celebrity-based culture. So if we could seed political oppression narratives throughout movies and television shows, that too would become a very powerful narrative that people would, you know, be affected by and compelled by.
So just so I understand better, then, would quote-unquote students of the Frankfurt School, would they consciously then infiltrate these venues such as education to foment dissent and to create this kind of chaos?
That's right. There were several prominent revolutionaries, particularly in the Weather Underground, Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn, who, you know, often many of them went on to have cushy chairs, you know, at the teachers' colleges in Chicago and various other places. So yes, and then oftentimes it's through sort of mentorship. So one of the more celebrity figures from that time period was Herbert Marcuse, who really was influential in various, you know, he was in San Diego for a while and various cities. He mentored various revolutionaries who became very pivotal in the movement. But he was renowned. I mean, I think the students just really saw, or he captured some zeitgeist in the student body that was sort of already questioning authority, and captured that, saw that that was potential, a seed that he could exploit, and exploited it very effectively.
Now, you mentioned the infiltration of and the influence of media, and you spent a lot of time talking about film, which I really found very interesting. There's a passage here I just would like to read. To be fair, some movies about oppression have highlighted real injustices, but even if grounded in reality, recounting and repackaging oppression narratives over and over again distorts our perception of that reality. Freezing and amplifying certain injustices effectively cements a narrative in the minds of the audience that this sort of injustice is more pervasive than the data might suggest. So tell me a little bit then about the movies about oppression, and specifically the oppression and overemphasis on oppression narratives.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, certainly movies oriented towards children and also towards adults used to be very different. There used to be more stories about people finding their courage, you know, heroic stories. You know, if you think of It's a Wonderful Life, I think I mentioned that book, that movie in the book as well. The revolutionaries really would disdain a movie like that because it's about a man finding real purpose and meaning in the more hidden things, you know, that he at first wants to live this glamorous life and then realizes it's actually in his marriage and his family and his community, investing in these things that he would really be able to make a difference. And the revolutionaries really understood that, no, we need to exaggerate stories of oppression. They were very explicit about that. Drive that narrative home over and over again in various ways. And if you think about, you know, most of the contenders for the Academy Awards in the last 10, 20 years, there's the vast majority of them are surrounding some sort of oppression narrative, either sexism, homophobia, as they would call it, racism. And what's tricky about it is that some of this is real, right? You know, it is good to expose that there's, you know, there's racial injustice. You know, we need to be aware of these things. Or, you know, men who maybe have been predatory or something. But insofar as we obsess over it, we really paint a picture that all men are sort of toxic or, you know, that the masculinity itself is a problem. Because we're the stories that we tell ourselves over and over again as a culture really affect our cultural imagination in ways that are either for the good or for ill. And I think we've done a lot of damage through that.
You specifically mentioned Frozen, which was the one of the biggest Disney hits of all time. And I know you have children. I have two small girls. They have the Elsa dresses, you know. What's going on there that you talk about in the book?
Yeah, no, I took my kids to the theater to see that. And within about 5 to 10 minutes, I remember thinking, oh, this is a gay pride movie. The narrative was seeded all throughout. I mean, she talks about, you know, love is an open door. They go to the trolls when she's born differently. You know, she has this ability to, you know, everything, if she gets upset, everything gets cold. I can't remember quite the narrative, but
ice.
And the trolls say, the wise trolls say she's born this way, you know, and then she rejects society and moves up to this mountaintop and transforms herself into this, you know, what really looks like a, you know, a glam transgender or, you know, performance artist or something, and sings about how there's no right, no wrong, no rules for me, I'm free. And the people who are opposing this are, you know, sort of the old-fashioned, oppressive, old townspeople. You know, these narratives are ubiquitous throughout these types of movies. And it became very clear that they're seeding a message in the children's imagination that to be a hero is to reject all sort of socially contrived taboo or morals and mores, to be a rebel, and that this is very different from what we used to tell children in generations past, where we were teaching them how to develop in virtue.
I should just point out, you know, it's based on a Hans Christian Andersen short story, certainly without the elements that you're
right.
discussing. So there was that that need to tell a hero's journey, for instance, and to promote, you know, the heroine role.
Yep.
But now it comes at a price, and you're really focusing on that, and you're really wanting people to see that's. And it's not just a Disney thing, it's for all ages, really. I mean, and all, now with the nominated films that years ago, Chariots of Fire was one that you, from 1981, could you see that, for instance, being competitive today, in today's nomination?
It's hard to imagine that movie getting the success that it did then. Yeah.
What is the diversity industrial complex, Noelle?
Well, I think I use that phrase just to say that, you know, DEI, so diversity, equity, inclusion, has really been, well, it's been exposed more. People are more aware of it. But for quite a while, it was a mechanism for capturing, you know, corporations, even the military and certain government and public institutions, by inserting sort of this requirement of diversity, equity, inclusion. It sounds like it's something that's good. Isn't it good to have diversity? Isn't it good to have equity and inclusion? But each word means something very different than what you think it means. So, for example, inclusion, it sounds like you're just including people, but what you're actually doing is saying anyone who has a belief that is not in line with DEI is actually going to make people feel left out. And so inclusion means including people who think along the lines of the ideology. Similar with diversity, you don't want, obviously, diversity of viewpoint. You want the same ideology promulgated with different representatives of different groups, politicized groups. So this is not true diversity of thought. It is not diversity with any depth. It's really diversity for the sake of conformity to the ideology.
There's a fascinating perspective that you give that I hadn't even thought about before with St. Peter. Mm. And you use the term groupthink. Mm-hmm. tell us just a little bit about what you're, for those who may not have known in the book, what's going on in that sequence.
Yeah, well, please. That was animated by having read Rene Girard, who talks about mimetic theory and the idea that we don't really like things in a vacuum. We tend to imitate, be mimicking our likes based on what other people like. So if you think about a house that lingers on the market, all of a sudden nobody wants to buy it because you're sort of imitating not only people's likes, but people's dislikes. No one wants that house, therefore I don't want it. And St. Peter in the story, and this is from Girard, he talks about how, the denial of Christ was really a mimetic, motivated out of mimesis for St. Peter, that as soon as the mob mentality of the crowd is very, it reduces the human person and sort of absorbs them. And in that reduction and absorption, we become very affected by the groupthink of the crowd. And so St. Peter, I think in that moment of weakness, he fell prey to this very human temptation of wanting to be alongside the crowd.
And we're talking about the sequence where it's, I saw you with him. And he says, no, he denies Christ three times. This is the example of groupthink that we're talking about. I thought it was quite revealing. Tell me a little bit about the difference between critical thinking versus critical theory. You lay that out.
Yeah, they sound similar, but they actually have very different ends. So the point of critical thinking is to arrive at the truth. So if your goal is the truth and you have an interlocutor and you disagree, you actually want him to challenge you and you want to challenge one another because your goal is the truth. So you want to course correct if you have strayed from sort of right thinking or logic. If you're doing critical theory, your goal is not the truth, your goal is power. And so rather than invite objections to your argument or your position, you want to silence them. You don't want to course correct, you want to dominate. And I think this confusion has led to a lot of frustration as people kind of engage with this movement, because one person might think that they're doing critical thinking, but the other person's doing critical theory. So you think you want to this person wants to dialogue with you. They don't want to dialogue with you. They want to dominate you. And so I think it's good to have that distinction in mind as we to evaluate whether a conversation is worthwhile, whether the debate is going to be oriented around the truth or whether we need to just, try to find common ground in some other way through hobbies or some other way to kind of reach the person.
Now, one of the things I enjoy about this book and this Awake Not Woke is you don't just end with doom and gloom and this grimness. You do offer some suggestions and solutions at the end as positive takeaways to a Christian response to the cult of progressive ideology. Tell me a little bit about maybe an example of one of the solutions that you propose.
Yeah, one of the most striking solutions to my mind is fatherhood. I think the twin targets of the movement are authority and innocence. And they go together, right? If you want access to the sheep, you got to take out the shepherd. And so I think that there's a reason why every revolutionary, from Marx to Mao to Marcuse, have always targeted fatherhood. Because they know that that's how you corrupt the next generation, is by getting rid of the father. So I think part of the restoration is that realizing this has been targeted because it's so powerful. It's such a remedy to cultural chaos. And so, I think out of the sexual revolution, we see a reduction of every member of the human family. Men tend to become soft because, St. Thomas Aquinas says that effeminacy is the inability to do what is arduous for the sake of what is good. And sexual revolutions incline men towards vice, right, and licentiousness. The unwilling, and they lose their masculinity in that way. The manly man is the man of virtue, the holy man. So men become soft, women become hardened, because they have a nature that is too valuable and vulnerable to endure the chaos of this, sexual revolution. And then children become unprotected. So I think one of the greatest remedies is to recognize that dynamic and say, masculinity, femininity are not stupid tropes or menacing ones. They're actually say something deep about the nature of the human person and how we were created and express different ways in which God is, that we are children of God. And so, I really think restoring that understanding that masculinity is about virtue and that is powerful and good. Restoring the sense that, women are called to be mothers, biological or spiritual. Men are called to be fathers, biological or spiritual. We're made for family. And the family really is the best remedy, I think. The family and the faith.
Well, how do you read the current landscape then? I mean, it feels sometimes overwhelming to combat this, kind of beast that's just moving through culture, moving through our lives, just upending and destroying, and but some people think is liberating. So navigating this, how do you feel about where, I mean, this is 2021, very prescient for today. How do you read the signs of the times?
Yeah. Well, one thing I would say is that I think at different times there are different apologetic emphasis. So in the 90s, I think apologetics were really big. Scott Hahn, you know, all these wonderful figures. They aided my reversion. And then a lot of people started talking about beauty, that beauty can pierce the human soul in an post-rational society. Now I really think we have gotten so fetishized the abnormal, you know, through queer theory and all of this stuff. Things have gotten so strange. Men can become women can become men, people can become cats or furries. You know, these are really bizarre lies running rampant. And the antidote to them is the remembering the ordinary injected with love. And so I do think ordinary, faithful families are an immense evangelical powerhouse. Having people for dinner, letting people who have not experienced, you know, a well-functioning, ordered, peaceful, happy home, bringing them into our lives, letting them see, you know, the happiness of the home life and the, you know, that it addresses the longings of their heart in very powerful ways. This is the big impetus behind Theology of Home, which I co-authored with Carrie Gress, our books and our website and our shop and media, is that, you know, a lot of people were sold a bill of goods through popular culture, magazines, television shows, movies, as I talk about in the book. They were sold a lifestyle that is toxic. And so we as Catholics have the lifestyle that actually helps you to flourish. So we need to be bold about that and say, like, pointing to the family and saying, this is something good, this is something beautiful, people want it, we have what people want. Let's not be in a defensive posture about it. Let's be forward thinking with it.
Similar to what you were saying about cowardice and not being, you know, not being, be not afraid to go into the deep. Overall, when you were writing this or looking back now on the process, was the ideology a specific attack against Christianity, against Catholic Christianity specifically? Or am I being maybe teasing it down too much?
No, I think it's pretty explicitly an attack on the faith for certain. You know, there's a reason why Karl Marx called religion the opiate of the masses, that, you know, the faith gives us a way to endure our suffering, to carry our cross, and in that carrying of our cross with love, we actually are united to love himself, to God himself. And that is a real obstacle to an ideology that wants you to say, believe that you're not defined by love, but you're defined by oppression and hatred. And that we have to center the oppression and hatred into the definition, very definition of the human person in order for the ideology to flourish. So, you know, Saul Alinsky famously said, we need to go out and rub raw the sores of discontent. Insofar as we're able to suffer well, we're able to live well, we're able to find joy, we're able to find peace, even during trials and tribulations. But no revolution comes from a stable society that is able to suffer well. A revolution comes from people who suffer loudly. And so you have to antagonize that. The sort of discontent amongst the populace. And so religion is the greatest obstacle to revolution.
How's the reaction been in the 3 years since the book came out? Any surprises, any secular reaction? What can you share about that?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I think that a lot has evolved since the book came out. So when it first came out, I would say that I got a lot of some pushback, even amongst people who would consider fairly faithful. And, you know, I think as the years have gone by, it's far less so. I think people have really started to see this movement with more open eyes. And in that process, I think it's sort of neutered the movement to a great degree, insofar as people are aware of what actually is happening. So the reaction has been, I find, there's been a lot more hope of more recently than versus when it first came out.
Are you working on anything else? Do you have projects that you want to pursue in the future? Where are you? Is there a follow-up planned, or just share with you what you have going on currently?
Yeah, I've just started writing a new book that is sort of the outgrowth of Awake Not Woke and Theology of Home. So one of the things I hear the most in speaking around the country is people who raised their kids well and their kids grew up and then became woke and are estranged from the parents or grandparents. You know, this is a very common story, and there's a lot of pain out there. And so it occurred to me, you know, rather than just thinking about a cure for this, what about if we think about prevention? How do we fortify our nation on the cellular level of the family and, you know, our church fortify the families with various principles, and then hopefully that can keep all this pain from happening in the future. So the next book is sort of with that in mind, fortifying families.
Are these Catholic families that you're seeing raising the children who abandon both faith
yep.
and family, sometimes who are so intertwined given good education and upbringing at homes?
That's right. Oftentimes it's very faithful families who I think did a great job, and you know, things went awry because I think we weren't quite as aware maybe of how toxic the culture and the ideology was out there. And you know, it's deeply invested in getting access to children through their media and through their education, inducting them into a grievance mindset, for example, which is very toxic to the faith.
Tell me, what is that? Tell me that. Just explain that for a grievance mindset.
So for example, one of the SEL, social emotional learning curriculums targeted at 6th through 8th graders has this one example. They will have students keep a problem diary where they are told to log their trigger situations. And some of the prompts they're given are things like, who left you out today? Who treated you unfairly today? Were your parents not there for you at an important moment today? In other words, they're training the kids to habituate their understanding of the world through the lens of who has harmed me. And that's the exact opposite of the faith, right? Where the faith knows that that's a human temptation to deflect from responsibility, to be an accuser, to look around and see who I can point the finger at. And the faith says no through the mea culpa, through the examination of conscience, through confession. Reorient your understanding so that you assume responsibility and you see how I can live with a service mindset, a mission mindset, instead of a grievance mindset. And so that grievance mindset, I think, is toxic for the human person, for the ability to form strong, well-functioning families, and also for the ability to understand that I have faults I have to deal with, and I also need a savior.
Noelle Maring, she's the author of Awake Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. Noelle, thanks for being with me.
And that was EWTN's James Day speaking with author Noelle Maring about her book, Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology, published by our friends at TAN Books, and of course, available through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. I'm Doug Keck. This has been a special edition of EWTN's Bookmark. We'll see you next time.